This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. In the aftermath of deadly mass shootings in Dayton and El Paso, President Trump paid visits to both cities this week. Following them, he took to Twitter and criticized some local leaders. Meanwhile, action on stricter gun laws appears to be imminent.
Some chanted, "Do something." And they were absolutely right.
That was Ohio Governor Mike DeWine responding to a crowd in Dayton chanting, "Do something." And the Friday News Review starts now with National Public Radio reporter Bracton Booker. Welcome, Bracton.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Cincinnati Inquirer state government reporter Jesse Balmer. Welcome back, Jesse.
Thanks for having me.
And Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter and producer Andy Chow. Welcome, Andy.
Hello.
Those of you listening, if you have questions or comments about this topic, give us a call at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets. Bracton, let's start with you. NPR sent you to Dayton as part of the coverage of this. What did you see there?
Yeah, when I first got there Sunday afternoon, the part of the Oregon district where the shooting took place was still partially blocked off. I remember when I first got there, first thing you kind of do with those situations, you look for the television news trucks. And when I couldn't get down Fifth Street in the Oregon district, I saw, you know, a bunch of law enforcement cars and police tape. So I had to hop out the car and kind of make my way as close as I could to the location. And you know, you see people that are visibly shaken. You see people crying. You see people like looking at each other, like, "How could this happen here?" And I tell you, I've covered a number of these mass shootings, and that expression that I see on people's faces, it doesn't get any easier to look at people going through all this anguish. So when I arrived, I tried to talk to people. Not everybody wants to talk, understandably, but then later on that evening when they had the vigil for the victims, a lot more people wanted to talk. And that clip you played where you hear the chant, do something, that was probably the time where I felt chills down my spine, because you could feel the reaction. That was really organic. That was not protesters with signs or anything. That was just people in the crowd yelling to the governor, "Do something, do something." So we'll see what comes of that.
We'll talk a little bit more about some of the specific angles that you approached on this story. But as you said, Bracton, it does appear with those chants that the governor has responded and there's movement. And so, Andy, you reported that some proposals by Governor Mike DeWine mark a shift in the gun debate. And I'm curious what that means.
Well, ever since 2011, Republicans have controlled the House, the Ohio Senate, and the governor's office, with former Governor John Kasich also being a Republican. So there has been little to no interest here in Ohio to really pass some strong gun control laws, some strong gun regulations. There was a moment in time last year in Governor Kasich's last year in office where he did try to push some things. I mean, he ceremonially introduced things, but there wasn't really a strong push from the governor's office in regards to him really working one-on-one with legislators. So with Mike DeWine calling for these gun regulations, with the kind of relationship he has with lawmakers right now, and with some Republican lawmakers signaling that they want to take this issue more seriously, that's what I mean, that there really might be a real shift in the conversation right now, and basically a drastic shift compared to just a few weeks ago, where we were seeing more pro-gun bills getting passed and getting a lot of hearings in House committee meetings. So it really remains to be seen exactly how far this might go, how seriously it's being taken. But so far, signaling from Governor Mike DeWine, it is something that he's taking seriously.
Bracton, you noted that you've had to cover a number of these mass shootings and that the visible signs of anguish are quite commonplace at these scenes. But what's not is action in the aftermath by people with legislative power. It does seem that with the dual shootings in Dayton and El Paso, that there is forthcoming action at the state level and also at the federal level. And I'm curious if you observed anything that's different about this one that seems to be inspiring this.
Well, I will just say that probably the fact that Dayton happened just hours after the deadly shooting in El Paso really brought this point home, that you can no longer really ignore that, you know, with some mental health experts folks who study this issue say that we have an issue with guns. We have a problem with guns, and it can't be easily swept under the rug, especially when you have so many people get killed over a weekend in the U.S. And this is not talking about, you know, everyday gun violence that happens in cities where one or two people get killed in a certain incident. This happened in a concentrated area where gunmen end up going to a particular spot to inflict harm on people that they don't know. So I think lawmakers are certainly getting the message that this is really not a partisan issue. This is a safety issue, a public safety issue. So I think that this is certainly marked the latest episode where lawmakers can say, like, okay, this can't be ignored. But as we've seen time and again, the more time that passes from these incidents, the longer it takes before lawmakers kind of come together and actually try to change something, that momentum kind of trails off, and there's not the same will to do something right away if something like this is allowed to linger.
Join our conversation at 513-419-7100. Jesse, there is a list of gun bills currently before the Ohio legislature. I guess some of them have probably been there for some time, consistently reintroduced, but these bills were already there before this tragedy in Dayton. So tell us about the status of them now, if we expect to see a little bit more momentum behind any of them.
Yeah, there's a number of proposals that have been put forward largely by Democrats who are in the super minority in the Ohio legislature. Things like raising the age to purchase guns to 21 years old, things like more background checks on more gun sales, closing the so-called gun show loophole, things like putting in stricter penalties if someone allows a child to get access to a gun at their home. It's not properly secured. So these are things that have been proposed over the past 7 months. Only one proposal has gotten even a first hearing, and that was one that had a Republican co-sponsor. It was looking at domestic violence, and currently there's a federal law that prevents those convicted of domestic violence from accessing firearms, but there isn't a state law that corresponds with that. So that was the one that got one hearing in the first 7 months. And so there is some frustration from Democrats about the lack of movement on their proposals before this happened.
We've heard from Governor DeWine. We've heard from Senator Sherrod Brown. We've heard from Mayor Nan Whaley. What are we hearing from state legislators, Jesse?
Well, I spoke with the Senate President Larry Opoff earlier today. What he is saying is that he likes the proposal from Governor Mike DeWine on these safety protection orders, these red flag laws, better than what was proposed by John Kasich last year. I think the key difference for some lawmakers is John Kasich's had this ex parte order basically allowing you to immediately remove firearms from someone who you deem to be dangerous to themselves or others. This proposal from Governor Mike DeWine earlier in the week requires at least a hearing, a probable cause hearing, before any guns are removed. So I think that's one factor. There's a slightly higher burden of proof on subsequent hearings. So the DeWine administration is really trying to distance themselves from what John Kasich proposed last year, saying, you know, we have these protections in place. And that's something that lawmakers are more likely to get on board with, but he isn't, you know, unilaterally saying, yeah, we're going to take a vote on this. Yes, I support this yet.
Yeah. And Michael, if I could add, when we're talking about bills that have already been introduced even before the shooting and even before DeWine rolled out his plans, it's important to remember that there was a mass shooting at Chardon High School in 2012, and that really set off a lot of this conversation among Ohio lawmakers. They even had hours and hours of hearings for a joint task force where representatives and senators all got together to really have extensive hearings on how to cut down on not only school gun violence, but just gun violence in general. And so they've already done a lot of the groundwork here. They've already laid out a foundation of what they think could help. And from those conversations years ago are still these remaining recommendations that Jesse laid out: red flag laws, expanded background checks, locking up guns in safes so kids can't get it. These are things, if people are thinking that maybe these proposals are being rushed right now, they're not. These are things that have had extensive conversations over the years.
And Bracton, you reported on the possible requirement that people who see things happening in schools would have to speak about them. And this shooter in Dayton did have a reputation, it's been reported, for being obsessed with death and violence. And I'm curious what you can tell us about that.
Well, yes. So the shooter, we'll try not to say his name, they did have a history of being odd to some people, making sexist remarks. And some people said that he was withdrawn. And some former classmates that I and my colleague Joel Rose, who was with me in Dayton, got reports from former classmates that he had this kill list or a rape list of with names of classmates on it that he wanted to inflict harm on. Now, the shooter was suspended at some point during his school years, but was allowed to later come back in. And we're not really clear on what kind of mental health treatment he received or any other additional discipline, because he was a minor and those records are kind of sealed. But in some of the proposals that Governor DeWine unveiled this week, I mean, he wants to make it easier for people to report some of these incidents to make sure that mental health experts can intervene before, you know, someone gets out of school and is no longer under the auspices of the government and the school system to try to get them that kind of treatment. So it's not clear how much this would have prevented the shooter from carrying out, but it certainly would have been a good first step had some of this been enacted while the shooter was still in school.
It's been 5 days since this tragedy. Have we learned anything more about the possible motives of this shooter?
Nothing more than, you know, we talk about the FBI is now involved because they are trying to investigate some of these, you know, quote unquote violent ideologies that the gunman had. Early on with the investigation, law enforcement said that there was nothing in this shooter's background that would have put him on law enforcement's radar before he carried out the shooting. They say that he had, you know, minor traffic incidents, but they now, looking back, they kept saying nothing as an adult would have put him on their radar. So now I think there is going to be a much deeper investigation and what happened while the shooter was in school. Because it seems like there were certainly some red flags that really could have gotten to some of these answers that we're now looking for and kind of what the ideology is with the gunmen. And I will say what the FBI is looking into, they're looking to see what ideologies had influence on the attacker, if he had help planning the attack, and if anyone knew beforehand that he was going to commit the attack. So we'll see where those investigations go.
And Bracton, as part of your coverage of Dayton for NPR, you spoke with the grandmother of one of the victims, 27-year-old Lois Oglesby. Her grandmother, J.P. Ann Ivory, is in disbelief. Let's listen to some of that sound.
Mm-hmm. So I don't understand, and I don't understand. I know God would get us through it, but I don't understand why our family.
It's so heartbreaking to hear these families, as we hear so many times in these instances across the country. What did you learn from the families dealing with this tragedy?
That, I mean, no one is ever prepared for a sudden loss like this. When I spoke to Lois Oglesby's grandmother, when I started to ask her about Lois, she's like, nobody called her Lois. This is Lois Lene Oglesby. She was named after her other grandmother. We called her Nene. We called her Nene or Nay. So, like, do not call her Lois. I did the story on Nene. And she said that, look, I mean, she was a warm personality. She was a feisty young lady. And even this is someone who was feisty even at a young age, according to her grandmother. And her grandmother said that, you know, she had lost focus a little bit after the birth of her first child. Wasn't quite sure on the career path that she wanted to take. But it was after the birth of her second child, Ray, that she felt like Oglesby really got some focus and was going to return to nursing school. And she was just going out to have a nice night out with friends. And she said, in her grandmother's words, she winds up dead. She winds up dead after that. So I think people are still trying to make sense of it, as they're also trying to make funeral arrangements. I think Miss Oglesby's funeral is going to be on Monday. So they're really having a hard time kind of coping on the senseless tragedy.
This has been a tough year for Dayton, Ohio, Andy. This is a city that was first earlier this year in national headlines because of this Ku Klux Klan rally. That turned out to be a pretty small event, but the response to it was huge, so it got a lot of coverage. And then days after that, these deadly tornadoes blew through the region, and now this deadly shooting. What are we hearing in general about the community of Dayton and how it's coping overall?
Well, a big general message that Mayor Nan Whaley has been pushing out over and over again is to make sure that everybody has each other's backs. And part of the message that she's been trying to put out there, especially through social media platforms like Twitter, is to make sure that everybody is connecting themselves with the kind of mental health care that they might need, some support care that they might need, to try to make sure that, I mean, we talk about the 9 people who were killed in the shooting and the more than 24 who were injured, but there were a lot of people on the street that night that might need psychiatric care or psychological care, some sort of treatment for possible post-traumatic stress. So there are all sorts of things happening, as you mentioned, in the Dayton community. But the message from leaders from the city has been to try to make sure you take care of yourself, to check in on each other, to help support each other however you can, especially possibly emotionally at this point.
And you're listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We're talking now with NPR's Brakton Booker, Andy Chow from Ohio Public Radio, and Jesse Baumert from the Cincinnati Inquirer. President Trump visited Dayton and El Paso, where the second mass shooting was, the earlier mass shooting was, over the weekend. And prior to his visit, he gave a national address on unity. But then he took a different tone on Twitter, attacking Senator Sherrod Brown and Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley over the Dayton trip. He took on Beto O'Rourke during the Texas trip. Mayor Whaley spoke earlier this week on the president's visit in an interview with NPR's Ari Shapiro. Let's listen to part of it.
I think the victims that that were in the hospital were super grateful for his visit. And our first responders, you know, he's the president of the United States, they were happy to see him. But it was tough in the city. You know, we had some skirmishes in the Oregon district of pro-Trump, anti-Trump. I mean, and really, the minute he announced that he was coming, we saw the rhetoric in the community just get really heightened. And before that, there was really a sense of people coming together.
President Trump can be rather polarizing, and he certainly is no stranger to inciting arguments. He loves to participate in it. If you follow his Twitter feed at all, he's always up for a fight. But this is sort of a national tragedy that requires a different type of behavior from a president. And this is a unique situation with this particular president behaving the way that he does. I'm wondering, Jesse, what are we now hearing from those local leaders based on what President Trump said about them in the aftermath?
Well, I believe Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley was around some reporters when she actually was reacting to seeing the tweets for the first time, including some of my colleagues. And so her initial response was, you know, oh, well, he lives in the world of Twitter. I think Senator Sherrod Brown came out with a little more forceful of a statement calling him a bully. Mm-hmm. So it was just, I think, disappointing. There might be a stronger word for that, to see something that could have been a really nice bipartisan unifying moment for. We had Republicans, DeWine and Senator Rob Portman there. We had Democratic Senator Brown and Nan Whaley. it could have been a nice moment for people to come together and support those victims and first responders. And it just seems like it quickly devolved into what it did.
And I think another issue that we're also seeing play out is there's also seems to be a lack of consistency among the president's own comments, where he might say one thing at one point and then a few hours later say something that goes against his own message. And so, like you said, there were people, or like what the mayor said, there were people who were trying to come together as a community, even though they might be polarized politically. And then when the president came in, it sort of created this group of protesters, group of supporters. But even among the president's own message, it's kind of unclear where he wants to take the country as far as gun policies go, as far as what kind of regulations we might see him push on the federal level. But then also, again, the question about his rhetoric and the words that he's saying, are they helping or are they hurting?
I have been impressed on kind of an Ohio level of how Republican Governor DeWine and Democratic Mayor Nan Whaley, who at one point was running for governor on that side of the ticket, have been able to, you know, come together. They had lunch together. They were talking about policies together. And I think even, you know, the mayor has been complimentary of how the governor has reached out to people on all sides of the political spectrum to get input on something that really, you know, as Bracton said earlier, is not necessarily a partisan issue, but certainly has become one.
And I don't know if we've mentioned this yet, but we've also seen Republican Senator Peggy Lehner put herself on as a co-sponsor on a Democratic bill. So you do see Republicans and Democrats on the state level trying to find a way where they can work together to show that unity.
And just piggybacking on the point of unity, at the vigil that we were talking about at the top of the discussion, when Governor DeWine was being shouted down as do something, when he finished his remarks, it was Mayor Whaley that took to the mic immediately after he was done and told the crowd that this is not the time for that kind of discussion. This is the time for healing. So, I mean, just to see how they were kind of working together in that moment, which was, it became a little tense. It just shows that there is certainly something going on in Ohio where leaders are coming together and working towards a solution.
We are certainly seeing examples of bipartisanship and people coming together the way that we do in the wake of these tragedies. We just have this very unique president who is so engaged on social media and really seems to have little filter for some of the remarks and the timing of his remarks, especially when they're in the backdrop of calls for unity and these dead people in two American cities. However, today, President Trump did tweet about the progress that's being made at the federal level in terms of talks about what could happen for stricter gun laws at that level. What do we know about possible federal legislation at this point?
Well, we know that nothing seems like it's going to happen until at least September. Mitch McConnell said in an interview with a local station in Kentucky that he's not planning to bring Congress back or bring the Senate back to have a vote on some of these gun proposals. Now, as you might know, that there were a couple of gun bills that had already passed the House earlier this year that would strengthen background checks and close a couple of loopholes, the so-called Charleston loophole that was at issue with the shooting down in Charleston in 2015. There seems to be a lot more talking that Mitch McConnell says he wants to see. Like he was also making the point that he does not want to bring lawmakers back just so that lawmakers can make political points. He wants to be able to pass something. He's expressed some support for red flag laws, but again, he's not calling on anyone to come back before the August recess.
Well, we should note that Mitch McConnell broke his shoulder last week, so he's somewhat incapacitated, or at least injured. And then Kentucky's other senator, Rand Paul, had part of his lung removed. So Kentucky's senatorial delegation really wouldn't be available until September, it sounds like, anyway. And I wonder what impact that may ultimately have. What are we hearing from the Ohio senators? Do they want to reconvene?
Well, I think they have a few sessions that are like if needed, so they could call them if they want to. I think you would see some of the proposals that are a little bit further down the line would get more immediate attention. For example, we talked about state hospitals and freeing up some space from them, including fewer people who are just sent there by the court in order to have a better understanding of the court process. That's something that a Republican senator introduced earlier this year. So I think you would see stuff like that moving a little bit quicker than really the big lifts are going to be this red flag law and the background checks. And so it'll be interesting what happens there.
And I think what we're hearing from Democrats is, sure, on the schedule, lawmakers aren't supposed to come back until around September. But Democrats have been saying, well, hold on, the House just called for basically an emergency session to pass the energy bill, which subsidizes nuclear power plants, effectively bailing them out with $150 million a year. If the House can call an emergency session to gather lawmakers from around the state for that, couldn't they do the same thing to take on an issue that a lot of people think is vital to keeping Ohioans safe?
Okay, I think we've got time for one quick phone call here. Let's go to the lines. We have Rick. Hi, Rick. What's your question or comment?
It's just a comment, and it's this. That I heard the president speaking this morning, I guess when he was going on vacation. If that shooter in Dayton, if we had real background checks, and if his juvenile record had not been sealed, those people might be alive today.
Rick,
because we have this system in the country where when you turn 18, it's like, oh, we seal everything up, and that could never happen. Well, that probably makes sense for some things, but it doesn't make sense for mental health. If you're mentally unhealthy at 17 and 365 days, you're mentally unhealthy the next day, too.
Rick, we appreciate the call. Thanks for calling in. And I also want to thank NPR's Brackton Booker for joining us today, Andy Chow from Ohio Public Radio, and Jesse Ballmer from the Cincinnati Inquirer. Thanks to all of you for this conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, the owner of the Cincinnati Inquirer, Gannett, is close to being sold, according to reports. What could that mean for the local newspaper of record? And later, the Archdiocese of Cincinnati faces tough questions from some parishioners following more allegations against a priest. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Gannett has owned the Cincinnati Inquirer since 1979, but that could soon change. Gatehouse Media announced its plans to acquire the McLean, Virginia-based media company, whose flagship publication is USA Today, and which owns other dailies in our part of the country, like the Louisville Courier-Journal and the Indianapolis Star. Gatehouse owns the Columbus Dispatch. The combined company would own more than 250 daily papers across the country. So what does it mean for Cincinnati's newspaper of record? The Friday News Review continues now with Poynter Institute media analyst Rick Edmonds. Thanks for joining us, Rick.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation, Michael. Good to be with you.
I'm hoping that you can give us the background on this. We don't really know a whole lot about Gatehouse Media in our region. Who are they and what do they want with Gannett?
Gatehouse is a chain that has been growing quite fast over the last, I'm going to say, five or seven years. They have backing of a very large private equity fund. So they bought a bunch of papers, and actually they have now a few more papers than Gannett. They're the smaller company, but they are stronger financially and have good access to borrowing, which was necessary to get this deal done. So that's where they're coming from. And as you said, Columbus is one of the papers they bought a couple years ago. And they bought several small chains and a bunch of other individual papers. So now they're buying the whole Gannett chain.
Yeah.
It's quite a swallow.
It is. And, you know, I mean, it's no secret that the newspaper publishing industry is hurt by decreasing print ad sales. And while I think we're seeing some improvements for revenue from digital subscriptions and digital ads, they're not making up for that loss from print ads. So What is the advantage here for two large corporations to join forces when they both face these same troubles?
Sure, that's a good question. I think in the first place, there are savings, and I'm not necessarily talking about making the newsroom smaller, though that could happen, but you know, you put two companies together, you don't need two heads of human relations or two different ad chiefs. So at the very top, there's that, and then a lot of what you might call backroom functions can be consolidated. And they're projecting savings synergies, they call them, as much as $300 million once this deal gets done, which probably won't, by the way, until the end of this year. It's an agreement in principle right now.
It's an agreement in principle. Is this something that's going to have to face federal scrutiny?
Well, that's a good question, too. The antitrust department has, to date, not shown any particular interest in this kind of combination. Of course, this one's bigger. But, you know, this may get their attention is about all I can say, because their ways are a bit mysterious. But I don't think this is, compared to other industries, this is not an unusual degree of concentration. We're talking about a sixth of the newspapers and not necessarily quite that much of revenue or circulation.
Media News Group, another publishing corporation, had come after Gannett earlier this year. And then Gannett had at one point, I understand, tried to buy Tribune or Tronc. And I'm just curious, those deals did not come to fruition for various reasons. What is it about this deal that appears to fit Gannett better than those other two?
Yeah, Gatehouse is a sort of a natural partner in having a lot of papers, having some in metro markets like yours, but many more in smaller cities. They both tried to use their scale to advantage by having advertising sold across a whole network of papers. That's particularly useful with digital ads to have a big total number. So, you know, all in all, it's kind of a courtship that ended happily, and it's put together over a long period of time, probably at least 6 months, probably longer than that. So Gannett was amenable to this, as they were not to the offer from Media News Group, which is a real sort of slash and burn outfit. And the little bit we can tell, Gannett is coming through this with quite a lot of role in the new company. So their newly named CEO is going to be the sort of operating CEO, and their chief financial officer is the chief financial officer. So, you know, we'll sort of have to see. They're going to, by the way, operate as Gannett, and the USA Today network is continuing as a brand, even though Gatehouse will have the controlling shares.
And I read in your reporting that idea is that obviously Gannett and USA Today have a stronger brand identity, even if they don't have as strong a financial position.
Correct, and I think you're quite typical of barely even hearing of Gatehouse, let alone having much of an impression of them.
Well, why did Gatehouse's stock take a hit after this announcement?
I think it's maybe dangerous to make comparisons to transactions past, but I think the market always has some skepticism when a smaller company takes a bigger company, and then we sort of double that because of the prospects of the newspaper business being uncertain, let's say. And I guess the heart of it probably is that there's a big borrowing involved here. I think it's $1.7 billion, and at a very high interest rate, 11.5%. So just meeting the interest payments on that and paying down the principal is going to be tricky. And I think that's the cause of the market skepticism.
Cincinnati has been a one newspaper town for about 12 years now. What can we expect from this newsroom at the Cincinnati Inquirer once this sale is complete?
Well, I'm cautious about predicting, but I guess I have to an extent. I don't know that the merger itself will result in a smaller newsroom. It might, especially with the factor I just mentioned, that they have to get a lot of savings and do some other things to make their financial obligations. What I think is more worrisome, it happened this week that all companies reported their second quarter results, and both those companies are still losing revenue at a somewhat alarming rate. So the story, a story in the industry has been downsizing, as I'm sure you and your listeners have experienced with the Enquirer. I think there's probably more of that in prospect unless this combination generates good revenue growth, which they hope for, but a little hard to see just how that will happen.
I'm curious what happens to these communities when there is a decrease in the amount of journalism, especially from the newspapers of record. And here in the Ohio Valley, almost all of the major cities have a Gannett property. We're talking Cincinnati, Louisville, Indianapolis, Nashville. Sure. This decrease in the amount of journalism, what tends to be the impact on those metro areas?
Yeah, well, I'll give you sort of a half and half answer. I think that the companies, including Gannett, have done pretty well of trying to focus the resources they still have on important stories, investigative stories. As you know, the Indianapolis Star basically blew the lid off the gymnastics scandal, and the Enquirer had some very good pieces as well. So that's a plus. What tends to get lost is some specialty beats, and then particularly coverage of communities that are a little bit, you know, further away, suburbs, exurbs. So many of the papers, I can't speak very specifically for Cincinnati, but have basically pulled back to the core city. So people who used to have some coverage and accountability coverage of their school board or city hall may simply not have that anymore.
And I know you got to run, Rick, but before you do, are there any examples of newspaper companies of significance that are doing well, that have discovered an answer to remain viable and competitive here in the digital
age?
Yeah,
I don't think there's one that's just the perfect model. One that I've written about several times and others have cited is the Star Tribune in Minneapolis. It's independently owned. It came out of a bankruptcy, so it doesn't have any debt. Very talented publisher and a owner who's a wealthy man in town who wants it to operate a little bit profitably. But while most of the industry has been shedding revenue very fast, the Star Tribune does enough things right, including a lot of new ventures, that they are keeping those losses to typically maybe 2% a year. So that's kind of the gold standard. There are other papers that I think do well. The paper in Charleston, South Carolina, smaller paper, has been quite successful. It's also family-run and run in a very ingenious way as a business. So it's not totally out of reach, but neither is there just kind of like a single magic formula that papers can adopt.
It's interesting that you cite a couple of independent newspapers that are locally owned. I'm wondering if this Gannett Gatehouse deal will inspire some of the other larger companies to pursue similar mergers.
Well, it certainly might, and I think that there's been rumors, really unconfirmed, that McClatchy and Tribune might be looking for merging with each other somewhere down the road, or might even, if this deal goes well, be pulled into the new Gannett, the bigger company. And I appreciate the point you made. We actually, at Point, are affiliated with the Tampa Bay Times, which is an outstanding independent newspaper. And it's a delicate balance, because the big chains do provide advantages of scale and technology systems that can be shared. But the individual newspapers, when they're community-owned, I think are in particularly good touch with their community and, may have a feel for what's appealing to an audience that's a little harder to achieve when you're managing a chain from a corporate headquarters a thousand miles away.
Rick Edmonds is with the Poynter Institute. We appreciate your time today, Rick. Thanks for explaining all that.
Hey, thanks. Good to talk to you.
Likewise. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Father Jeff Drew faces allegations of misconduct, and now the Archdiocese of Cincinnati is being asked tough questions by parishioners at the Butler County Church that Drew served. He served other churches in the area as well. Auxiliary Bishop Joseph Benzer failed to report previous allegations. What does this latest crisis in the local Catholic Church mean? The Friday News Review continues now with Catholic News Agency reporter Ed Condon. He joins us on Skype. Hi, Ed.
Hi.
And Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Dan Horn. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you.
513-419-7100 is the number to call if you have questions or comments in this segment. Ed, before we get into the very specifics of this local case, can you talk in general about why we're still seeing cases like this emerge? Does it appear that there's still a lack of due diligence or supervision or reform within the American church?
I think really what this case particularly highlights is a lack of good internal procedures in the Archdiocese of Cincinnati. In one sense, it's kind of reassuring, because although there were complaints being received about this particular priest, Father Drew, as far back as 2013. From everything that's come out and that we've learned, it's very clear that local law enforcement were immediately contacted on every occasion, that there were investigations from the sort of civil side of everything. But it was internal communications within the Archdiocese that seemed to have really failed here. And I think this highlights what's really been the locus of a lot of the scandals that have hit the Catholic Church in this country over the last 12 months, which is really one of how bishops behave and how they behave internally with their own structures in dealing with these complaints.
And in this particular case, Ed, there seem to be multiple pieces. We've got one priest facing allegations of misconduct, and then we have a higher up within the Archdiocese itself being criticized for the way that he handled it. Can you just quickly explain to us what's happening?
Well, so what's happened is that allegations against Father Drew were made in his former parish of St. Maximilian Kolbe in 2013 and in 2015. And Bishop Joseph Binzer, who's the auxiliary for the Archdiocese, sort of the Archbishop's right-hand man, if you will, received these allegations as part of his role and function and everything. And he made sure that they went to the local sheriff's department. They were all investigated. But he didn't inform the priest personnel board, which he was the head of, and he didn't inform the Archbishop Dennis Schnur. So when this priest came up for a transfer, which he applied for in 2018, that was sort of waved through and no one raised any objections because the board that was considering the application was simply unaware there'd been this history of several years of complaints. Now, what he's accused of, inappropriate contact and comments and even physical contact with teenage boys, text messaging, that sort of thing. You know, everyone's been very clear right away and along the line that there's no suspicion or evidence of criminal activity here. But there's definitely a clear falling short of the priestly standards that the Archdiocese has. And why that wasn't acted on in a more robust and systematic way is an open question.
And Dan, you reported at the Inquirer that since this story came out that the Archdiocese has received about a half dozen additional complaints about Drew from his days at St. Ignatius, St. Maximilian, St. Jude in Bridgetown. He was a music minister prior to becoming a priest. How are those cases being handled?
Well, apparently, but in the same way that this one was, they were reported to prosecutors as soon as they came in, according to the Archdiocese, and they are under investigation just as the ones that brought this all to everyone's attention were investigated. At this time, prosecutors are saying they don't have anything that rises to the level of a crime. It's just more of a behavior issue, and as we noted, I'm sure Ed's noted it too, the decree on child protection is not just about abuse, it's not just about criminal behavior, it's about behavior with children overall. It covers things like bullying, comments that you make to kids, texting, being alone with kids, that kind of thing. None of that is permitted, and so when you have a priest doing those things, it raises red flags, or should.
What are local Catholics saying, particularly the ones in the parishes impacted, Dan?
Yeah, I think this has created a little bit of PTSD for folks. You know, this is a really traumatic thing for victims, of course, but also for lay Catholics, for Catholic administrators and bishops and the institution itself. This has been a challenging time for the church since 2003 when this all blew up again. That was not the first time it's blown up. But when all those allegations came to the surface, I think, people saw laid bare at dioceses like ours and others that, you know, the church had permitted this to go on. It had actively, in some cases, covered it up. They had moved priests around to the great harm it caused to children. And so when you see something like this happen, even though a child abuse allegation is not involved, I think people immediately get a here we go again mentality. And I think that's what happened in this case. And it's understandable. You know, this has happened here. You know, we've documented that in stories we've done. And to see it happen, even though it doesn't involve abuse, I think that really raised some red flags for people.
And Ed, what are you hearing from members of the local Catholic community?
Well, from what I'm hearing from a lot of local members of the Catholic community, including those who work in the Archdiocesan Chancery and sort of it at an organizational level, is they were furious to discover this, that they, you know, a lot of hard work has been done to make the Catholic Church really one of the safest places for children in America today. And this is exactly the kind of thing that undermines all of that good work. I've heard privately from a number of people in his immediate orbit that the Archbishop Dennis Schnur was himself furious about this. this, that, you know, the phrase that that was told to me was that he went nuclear about it. And I think there is really no longer a well of patience and understanding to draw on for many Catholics in these circumstances. You know, the time for saying, well, we're, you know, mistakes were made and we're looking at structures and trying to get it right, that's really passed, and it's passed some time ago. That everything that can reasonably be done is already on paper somewhere. And this is really a question of not even the exercising of poor judgment, but the deliberate ignoring of what were clear lines of reporting and authority by Bishop Binzer.
And I believe both of you reported on another priest that we learned about this week as well. Dan, what do we know about Father Clarence Heiss?
Heiss is on administrative leave. That was disclosed recently by the church. They have not discussed the reason for that. He had previously gotten into trouble some years ago for some activities not involving children. He was actually arrested for disorderly conduct, and he was placed on leave for, I think, 3 years. He underwent counseling. Again, they have made clear that did not involve children.
But it was at a park.
But it was Fairborn. At a park in near Dayton area, correct. And so he had that already on the books, and then they had received some other complaint related to him, which they have not disclosed. But he is on administrative leave. So he and Drew are the only two priests at this time on administrative leave in the diocese.
So, Dan, when these cases emerge, and now the Archbishop is dealing with this, you still have the memories from 2003 and all the incidents that have followed fresh in people's minds. What is the church doing to enhance or repair or even rebuild its credibility?
Well, I think they are trying to establish procedures in-house and procedures that they are more transparent to the parishioners, where they actually, when something like this happens, they publicly disclose it, they explain themselves, they apologize for it, as they have done in this case. That would not have happened 20 years ago or 30 or 40 years ago. We would not have heard of this then. And so that is a change. And so they are doing those things and they are behaving differently. There was an internal breakdown clearly in this case. And I think that's why a lot of people were very upset about it, including the Archbishop, because they thought they were moving past this sort of thing. And but the church has changed the way they deal with these complaints when they come in, and they are trying to be more transparent. Although, you know, there is more information we would like to know about this case and others. And, you know, the church is a private institution. There is no requirement for them to disclose, you know, what we would often like them to disclose. So we are at their mercy in many cases in terms of getting this information, unless we get it from other sources, which we sometimes do. But so while they are being more transparent, there is still a lot of material out there that, you know, we don't have access to.
And Ed, in our last 30 seconds here, is this the standard that we're seeing in dioceses across the country? Is that they are more forthcoming now than previously?
Absolutely. I think we can't underestimate the work that's been done in the last 20 years. But what I think we're seeing really in these two cases in Cincinnati highlight that is there's still a question of tightening up the procedures for things that aren't criminal offenses, and that this is the gray area that really needs to continue to be dealt with. An interesting thing to do with accountability will involve the future of Bishop Binzer in Cincinnati, because Pope Francis has published a lot of new rules and regulations in the last year concerning bishop accountability. So it'll be interesting to see how those are applied.
Ed Condon from the Catholic News Agency and Dan Horn from the Cincinnati Inquirer. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.